That's music from Denise Davis and her song Wonderful Counselor. We heard from Fernando Ortega as well. Angel Fired from Kathy Mattea. Gone Gonna Rise Again. 13 minutes past the hour. It's a Tuesday morning, and that can mean nothing other or no one other. No, nothing other than our conversation with Dr. Don Clark of Creation Moments. Don, a biochemist and member of the board of Creation Moments. He joins us from Garden Valley, Texas, as he does most Tuesday mornings. Good morning, Don.
Well, good morning. It's a nice, it's kind of a damp Tuesday over here.
Is it? Is it raining over there?
Okay. Well, it rained yesterday, then it cleared up, and it was beautiful, and it looks like it's kind of drizzly this morning.
Okay. Well, I was looking at the National Weather Map earlier. There's clouds in many areas of the country, not a whole lot of sunshine around. Up here, though, we've got sunshine, 39 degrees.
And it, oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, that's autumn here. It gets cold at night. It gets up into the 40s, maybe 50 today, but it's, the autumn kind of came early. And in a kind of a disappointing phenomenon, too, you know, the fall colors in our area, at least some areas of Minnesota, the fall colors progressed nicely. And here, they took a while. But now with the wind up, most of the leaves are going down before they fully turn, which is kind of a disappointment.
That's too bad.
We look forward to that every year, you know. But still falls in the air, and we enjoy that, too. Say, have you heard about the eclipse coming up tomorrow morning? It's a
horizontal eclipse of the moon. One of four, which I think we've talked about on this program before.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, October the 8th, I believe, is tomorrow.
It's supposed to be at the crack of dawn, visible only on the East Coast, though, so you and I are gonna miss it. And but it's just a highly unusual thing. I'm looking for the word here. It is a selenilial. It's a selenilian eclipse is what it is. And it's one of the few times both the moon and the sun will be visible at the same time, because light bends through the atmosphere at that point, and it allows you to see both the sun and the moon, and there'll be a dark red color, maybe even a turquoise color, to the moon tomorrow. So it could be interesting for those folks on the East Coast. Other areas of the world will have a good view of it. That's at 6:25 Eastern time, so if you're listening out there on the East Coast this morning, you can take a look at that. You want to get up, and I guess you have to look east and west simultaneously. you have to do a quick spin.
Right, if you want to see the sun and if you want to see the moon. So
Yeah.
But it's another one of those blood moons. And whether or not it has any biblical significance, well, we'll see.
Yeah,
I guess we will. At the end of the fourth one, if anything major happens next year. But there were two blood moons this year, and then there's two blood moons next year.
Okay.
There's a solar eclipse in the middle of them somewhere.
Okay.
But, yeah, so we'll see.
Well, interesting phenomenon up overhead and also down underground, apparently, at least over in China. There's an article over at the Institute of Creation Research that asks the question, Jurassic squirrels? Sounds like a note of questioning there in the title, but it's about some Chinese paleontologists who have described in the journal Nature six tiny skeletons that they say comprise a new species. Tell us about this, Don.
Well, they did find some skeletons, and the interesting, a couple of interesting things about it. One, they look like squirrels, except they're small, so maybe they're chipmunks instead of squirrels.
Yeah.
But they aren't calling them squirrels; they're calling them squirrel-like, and so. So it's interesting how paleontologists do just refuse to accept that animals do not, that once you're in a particular kind, that kind of animal doesn't change. So, but if you're coming at it from a evolutionary point of view, which these folks were coming as at this particular problem, they thought this was a interesting discovery because the Jurassic animals, or the pretty much say pre-flood animals, were shrew-like and not tree dwellers. And apparently The surprising thing about these particular fossils is that they were definitely, you know, characterized as tree dwellers.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, we would that would certainly fit with a small squirrel, you know, kind of a notion.
Well, they're trying to add to the lore of the origin of mammals here, and it would be a lot more exciting and probably a feather in their cap, as the these Chinese paleontologists would see it, to have discovered a new species, wouldn't it? Is there an inclination among paleontologists or even other scientists to lean toward, when there's question like this, to lean toward discovering new? Does that advance their own career? Is there something kind of egocentric about this?
Well, there could be. Of course, we don't know these particular Chinese scientists, mm-hmm. Yeah, often if you can, and a lot of these folks put their own names to the new name of the species or animal that they find, or, you know, bacteria or whatever it is, these folks aren't necessarily doing that, but they are putting it into a new group, or clad, as they call it, mm-hmm. Yeah, they're giving him a different, you know, a new name, as you know, suggested.
Well, there's a comment from the American Museum of Natural History here. It's their press release. It says, the animals which researchers have placed in a new group, or a clad or clade, I guess it's pronounced clad, called, and I can't say that word, likely looked similar to small squirrels. Well, if they looked like squirrels, maybe they were squirrels.
Well, maybe they were, and like mm-hmm. I said, the interesting find was that they're tree dwellers and not shrews, which, you know, were living on the ground,
mm-hmm.
Or underground. So you know, these animals definitely were not underground creatures. They had the skeleton of a squirrel. So
okay. Well, and they bring up the idea of the cave bears too that once lived in Europe, but and kind of this is a parallel, because they say today's relatives of the ancient cave bears are the grizzlies and the polar bears and black bear varieties. They're still on the earth. So the cave bear was not a new species. It was simply a different. How does that organization go? There's family and species, and what's the organizational table? I've lost that from my high school days.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you got you've got families, you've got genus, and then you've got species.
Mm-hmm.
So
squirrels would be a family or a genus?
Well, it depends. They're in a family, they're mm-hmm. in the animal. And then you've got kingdoms, because you've got the animal kingdom and you've got the plant kingdom.
So mammals would be a kingdom? No.
No, mammals would be a family.
Family, okay.
And then you've got, the genus,
mm-hmm.
and depending on what genus they would fall in. But then you have species, because you can have, for example, different species, but the species could be a, you know, one might be a brown looking squirrel, the other one might be a black squirrel with, you know, white spots or something.
Mm-hmm.
They might, you know, put those in two different species, whereas they would only have different colored coats, for example. Or maybe, you know, one squirrel would pretty much live on the ground and the other squirrel would live in the trees, and they might call those a different species.
Mm-hmm.
But it's purely man's classification. We would generally think of the kind as described in Genesis as being in the plant family.
Mm-hmm.
So while we have, I don't know what the exact number is, but let's say we've got tens of thousands of species, we really only have about 1,000 or less than 2,000, family mm-hmm. members, if you will, or
okay.
family groups. And when we're, you know, trying to relate this back to Noah's flood, for example, and all the animals, you know, going into the ark, some evolutionists or atheists would argue you couldn't get that many animals in the ark. Well, if you're looking at species, and you're looking at, you know, 50,000 or 100,000 different species or more, Well, those are a lot of animals to put in there two by two. But if you're just looking at the kind, because that's what we were interested in the first chapters of Genesis, then where it's a much lower number and very well, very easily could fit, one or 2,000 or even 5,000 different kinds of animals into the ark.
And what's the name for the kind of incremental changes that really was observed by Charles Darwin, especially in the finches, where a species will adapt to a particular climactic characteristic or a dietary? What's the word for that small kind of change within a species?
Oh, are you talking about mutation or something?
Well, there's another word that describes
microevolution.
There you go. That's what I'm looking for.
He didn't observe the change. He just observed all of these different finches, and I believe it was, close to 17 different, different kind, not kinds, but different different looking, finches. He took back maybe 15 samples, back home with them, and because some had large beaks and some had small beaks, and he said, well, this animal evolved into this animal, but when you even go back and look at that, it was due to the environment that they were in. For example, when it rained a lot on the Galapagos Islands, then the finches with the small beaks could grow and multiply, and because they were after the softer shelled seeds that would obviously grow once a plant grew and it had seeds, the seeds were easily accessible. But when things dried out, then the seeds pods would drop to the ground, and now the seed pods were very, very hard. And the finches with the small beaks couldn't crack the seed pods, so that population would almost die out, not completely die out, but would almost die out because of a lack of food source. And the finches with the larger beaks that could crack the seed pods would survive and would multiply, and so you'd have a population shift. It's not a evolution. It's not microevolution. It's just a shift in population, and it's just variation within the same kind, which is a finch. The finch didn't, go into a blackbird or anything like that. The finch stayed a finch, but just like we have different shaped heads. And we look different from even different population groups. These birds, look different and, had different size beaks and everything in between.
Now, I'm looking at this article about the squirrels, too, and I'm thinking there must be a temptation if they find an ancient skeleton that's maybe several feet down or several yards down into a layer of rock to have... And then knowing that there's a counterpart to that in squirrels. We have modern squirrels. The squirrels are all over the place. So they find a squirrel-like skeleton, let's say 20 feet down in a rock layer. The tendency, it seems to me, is to assume, well, there must have been an evolutionary process between the two. Therefore, this is a different animal. This is an earlier animal, even though it looks so similar. Is there some judiciating body, some commission, some council somewhere that will look at that and say, no, that's really just a squirrel. It's just an old squirrel. Rather than, we wish there was.
Yeah. Well, if you have a worldview that everything evolved, then, of course, your conclusions are going to be based on that particular assumption. And so, obviously, if you find a fossil species that looks kind of similar to what you've got today, you're going to call it something new because you got to have evolution. And this was a long, if it's in the Jurassic period, we're talking about millions of years ago. So obviously there had to be some change between then and now. Hadn't there? I mean, shouldn't there be? Yeah. I mean, with that particular type of thinking.
Sure.
But, of course, all of these finds that of these fossils, you got to ask the question, when did the fossil actually form. Of course, the global flood is the best explanation as to how do you capture a bird, I mean, in this case, a squirrel, in, you know, layers of mud. Of course, you know, they're rock now in the mud. You know, when the mud dries out, it mm-hmm. solidifies into rock, sedimentary, you know, rock. It then turns into the sediments then turn into mud, into
rock. How long does it take to make a fossil? Is there a standard, you know, or is it a round number that can be applied? Does it take thousands of years? Does it take 15 years? Because we've learned that what used to be thought of as events that took geological time, that is tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, can actually happen very quickly. How fast could a fossil form?
Well, all you need is mud. And you need to encapsulate. Here's the main problem with, not the main problem with fossils, but in order to have a fossil, and especially a complete animal, and it doesn't say in this particular article whether they found complete animals or not, it has to be encapsulated in mud while it is still alive.
Oh.
Because if an animal dies, of course, it starts to degrade very, very quickly, and then, of course, you've got all kinds of other animals and insects that come along and destroy it. If you ever took a snake that you killed, for example, and just leave it on the ground for a period of time, at least here in Texas, that animal will be completely consumed, except for the skeleton, within a day by the ants. Mm-hmm. And so you have to have a catastrophe, and what better catastrophe for these type of layers than the global flood. So the animal then gets encapsulated in mud. So it's void of oxygen at that time, but it's wet, and you probably had a lot of minerals in the water at that time, because one, it was the flood, and two, you had a lot of volcanic activity going on during the flood or in post the flood. So there were a lot of minerals in the water, and that then helps the fossilization process. So how long does it take a fossil to form? Well, under these conditions, under the pressure that you would have after multiple layers of the sedimentary deposits that were being formed, it probably would take less than 50 years, and not thousands and thousands of years, because all you're doing is exchanging. I mean, eventually the organic matter would degrade, but it's being exchanged with the minerals in the water, so you do have to have water present. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you would have that after the flood. And even though the land was drying off, the layers, the multiple layers, and we're talking about thousands of feet deep. This sedimentary rock that's around the world, the average depth for the sedimentary rock is 6,000 feet.
Oh, my goodness.
And in some places, so which is about 1,800 to 2,000 meters, mm-hmm. in some places, especially along the coast, the sedimentary deposits are 15,000 meters. So we're looking at 45,000 feet of sediment mm-hmm. that was generated during the flood. So this whole business of finding these fossils and calling them, different names and saying, well, because this is in the Jurassic layer and it's just a different sedimentary layer. Well, the Jurassic layer goes around the world. So how did that layer, they don't ask the simple question, like, how did that layer get there in the first place? You know, I mean, why is that layer there?
Fairly uniform, clear around the Earth, then.
And it's the division between that layer and the layer on top of it and the bottom of it is very, very, distinct. It's mm-hmm. not, we're not talking about a fuzzy or a gradual, transition from one layer to the next. Mm-hmm. You look at these layers, and they're very well distinct. That's why they can classify them.
So the mere existence of the Jurassic layer then should be evidence for a global flood.
Well, and the various other layers that they name, it very much evidence of the global flood. Mm-hmm. But these folks say, well, okay, that deposit took place over millions of years. Well, if it took place over millions of years, it wouldn't be so well defined. As a matter of fact, you wouldn't be able to distinguish between one layer and the next.
Or at least there would be some cataclysmic event at the bottom and again at the top. Something changed quickly.
Right, but these layers tend to be fairly homogeneous. And by that I mean that the particles within that layer that made up that particular rock are fairly well uniform.
Now, chemically the same or very similar from top to bottom of the layer then.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they say, oh, well, that's this particular type of layer. But, of course, they name the layers based on the fossils that they find in them. Mm-hmm. And then they name the, once they determine that, oh, this is the Jurassic layer, then they name the fossils according to the layer that it's in. So it's a kind of circular type of argument.
Do we have new fossils then? If fossils could form in as little time as say 50 years, are we finding new fossils and able to date them accurately?
Well, the interesting question would be, you need to have a catastrophe. So it would either happen after, let's say, a tsunami.
Let's say Mount St. Helens. There was a lot of earth moved in a huge flow, and that was, 30 years ago? And in another 50, 60 years, could we be finding fossilized remains of animals that were present in that mess during the Mount St. Helens eruption?
Well, we should. I mean, we should find all kinds of vegetation because the trees that were on the side of the mountain, there was a frozen lake up at the top at Mount St. Helens. Of course, it melted when the volcano erupted, and it blew off one side of the mountain, and all of that water, which then mixed with dirt and it became mud, slid down the mountain, and brought all thousands and thousands of trees down to Mira Lake, which was at the bottom of the mountain. So, and it should have trapped some animals, although animals are pretty pretty sensitive to earth movement and stuff, and they may have vacated the area before the catastrophe happened. But that is an interesting question. And maybe if one could, starts digging in the area, you might indeed find some fossils at some point in time. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because Mount St. Helens is a micro example of the global flood. And by that I mean that there was a canyon that was formed within hours, after the mudslide, 160 feet deep. It didn't take thousands of years, or it didn't take millions of years. It took hours to form, because you had the mud, the lake, that was on top, rushing down the mountain, and then subsequent to that, there was another rush, that came through. So you had the layers, laid down, and then following that, there was another, rush of water. That came, and it carved a canyon 160 feet deep. Hmm. Like I said, not multiple, not thousands of years, but certainly within a day and within hours, mm-hmm. That canyon was formed. This is all recorded. And if you go, this particular article that we're talking about today is on the site Institute of Creation Research, mm-hmm. and that particular site has a lot of information about Mount St. Helens, and Stephen Austin was the geologist who did a lot of work, mm-hmm. Back in the 80s after the
should mention the Institute of Creation Research here too, and their website, because particularly if you are an evolutionist, if you believe that that's the way it all happened, and yet you have an open mind and are willing to look at some science that suggests otherwise, and shouts loudly that no, it happened another way. It's a great website, and the topics are neatly delineated there for you. You can click on links and read just a wealth of articles at the Institute of Creation Research. That's ICR, Institute of Creation Research, ICR.org. And if you have an interest and an open mind, I recommend that wholeheartedly to you. There's another article over there about whale leg bones. Now, I've long heard, Don, that whales used to be land animals and somehow went back to the sea, which seems to be kind of counterintuitive to me. But I suppose if you're a whale and you ran out of food, you'd think about it. But if you were stalking the land, what an odd thing to turn around and go back into the ocean. What's this story about whale leg bones that we're looking at?
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, this is a whale of a story.
A fish tale. It's,
yeah, the whole thing stems around these what was thought as vestigial organs, kind of attached or partly attached to what looked like a hip bone in the whale. And I mean, this is going back, you know, for years. So the evolutionist, you know, looked at this and said, "See, here's, you know, little remnants of legs from the whales, and that's why we think they walked on land at one point in time." Well, you know, the more they look, eventually somebody in the the research world is honest, and they said, "Folks, these aren't legs. These are actually part of the reproductive system." And so it has nothing to do with legs. It never had anything to do with legs. Whales always have been in the water, and they weren't on the ark because they didn't walk on the ark. Mm-hmm. And they didn't need to be on the ark because they were big enough to survive the global flood and all the trauma that happened during the flood. So now, a recent article came out and said, "Hey, you know, folks, these are there's nothing unusual about all of this. These are part of the male sexual organs and the supporting structure, you know, for that." Mm-hmm. And so they had, and all of this, you know, came about because of the large pelvic bone that the whale had, and well, you know, this large pelvic bone is needed for the whale's reproduction.
Well, who decides that something is vestigial then? Because we've had other experience with supposedly vestigial organs. I'm thinking of our own, what do you call that? Appendix, that's what I'm calling
appendix.
It.
Appendix, yeah, the appendix that's was been supposed termed to vestigial. Be vestigial, mm-hmm. And of course the tonsils were supposed to be, vestigial organs. And it turns out those have very important functions in the immune system. And hey, how about that? And your appendix actually houses or supposed to house until you take it out, bacteria and good bacteria that is very much part of a healthy immune system. Mm-hmm. Same way with the tonsils. And so the tonsils get infected, and I had my tonsils taken out, and you probably had your tonsils taken out.
No, I still got mine.
Have yours. So, yeah. Well, you know, I got an infection somewhere along the line, mm-hmm. and they said, "Oh, you got to have your tonsils out." Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is the problem with man's thinking. If we have a creation worldview, nothing is vestigial. Nothing. I mean, everything is there for a purpose.
Well, I mean, even in the evolutionary view, if you still got it, it should still be in use, which means it is not vestigial.
Well, the evolutionary, worldview would say, well, this is just remnants of the evolutionary path.
So they would say someday it'll be gone entirely is what they're saying.
Yeah, because it's not being used, mm-hmm. and so the genes eventually will, you know, not be passed on to the descendants. Well, we know that that's ridiculous because anybody in genetics, you know, knows that, the DNA pretty much gets transferred from father and mother to, you know, to the child. Sometimes that doesn't happen, you know, completely, or there's a extra copy of genes, as we have in Mongolism, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, for the most part, you know, things get copied very, very well, and there's multiple mechanisms to make sure that that happens.
You know, a lot of these decisions on what's vestigial and what's not, and other scientific decisions seem to stem from the 19th century. So many things that we're discovering now, scientists concluded for sure then were invalid conclusions, were mistakes. They were wrong. Was there and I guess I'm asking you now about the history of science. There must have been a certain kind of euphoria, an atmosphere around science when all of a sudden it was the focus of attention by society, and medicine was making huge leaps and bounds of progress, and things were being discovered and analyzed and categorized and cataloged for the first time. Science kind of got carried away with itself, I think. Would that be accurate?
Well, it did, and this that period of time also was when, of course, Darwin's book came out. Mm-hmm. And so, not that scientists jumped on it. Matter of fact, they jumped on Darwin for even suggesting that evolution was a possibility. That wasn't the way God designed it. But eventually, the idea caught on, and so folks began to look at the world from that point of view, and so, you know, they came up with these ideas of vestigial organs, and you know, evolution, looking at transitions, looking for transitional forms, and they're having a very hard time, you know, finding them, and they're really are stretching in order to find vestigial organs or to find transitional forms in animals. Mm-hmm. So they're jumping on anything that has even the remote possibility, and so it's a kind of a, you know, I like to look at it from this point of view. It's the evolution is a bottom up type of thing, and creation is a top down. So when evolutionists see something similar between, you know, two different animals, for example, they said, "Ah, you see, those animals had to come from the same branch in the tree." Mm-hmm. In the evolutionary tree. And, of course, you know, we creationists look at it and say, you see, they were designed by the same creator.
And all the time, this tree was a figment of the imagination of some graphic designer someplace.
Well, exactly.
To illustrate
just relationships. Like, just
here.
Like the ape to man picture that you see mm-hmm. in many museums and things, that's just a figment of man's mm-hmm. imagination. I mean, God did create us to be creative. And man is very, very creative, and I mean, we, you know, that's part of our character that God put in us. But when we go against God's word and actually start imagining things that without God, then that doesn't glorify God, obviously, and it doesn't help man either.
Yeah, I think not. We're talking with Dr. Don Clark, a biochemist, member of the Board of Creation Moments. And we've talked about the Institute of Creation Research website, icr.org. You should also know that there's a Creation Moments website. It's creationmoments.com. You can link to it from our Broken Road radio site if you're so inclined. There also you will find a wealth of information and science included about young earth creationism. And if you're at all interested in knowing both sides of this whole discussion, it's a great place to stop, creationmoments.com. I will link the ICR, the Institute of Creation Research articles, to our podcast when that gets up on our website here in a couple of hours. You can share that with friends if you want. You can download the conversation, send it to people, or just refer them via a link. But I think lots of people would find this interesting, what Dr. Don has brought to us today. The little tiny squirrels and the whale's leg bones, well, yeah, right.
maybe the whale wasn't a tetrapod after all.
Yeah, I think not. Well, Don, we're grateful to you again. Thank you very much for taking the time, spending with us, and you can go tend your grapes now, huh?
Well, I got to go find some dolomite to put on the ground get some calcium and magnesium in there for next growing season.
You'll get some of that under your fingernails probably too, huh?
I would guess. Yes.
Don, we'll talk to you next Tuesday, okay?
Okay, very good.
Take care, Dr. Don Clark.
You too.